Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Little Beirut, as George Herbert Walker Bush used to call the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Welcome to our program, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on AirAmericaRadio.com, WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, CRN Digital. Don Alexander is the author of Darnia's Quest, what's represented as a Christian alternative to Harry Potter. His website, Darnia's Quest, D-A-R-N-I-A-S, Quest, Q-U-E-S-T.com. Don, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Don, I haven't read the book. I put that, you know, right up front. But my understanding of it is that although it's characterized as a Christian alternative to Harry Potter, the words Jesus or Christ don't appear in it. Am I wrong?
Yes, the words Jesus and Christ do appear in it. I wouldn't say they appear, often as you would see in other religious books. So, to help.
But it's basically not an evangelical book. It's an adventure story.
Well, the main character is very evangelical in his spirit, and one of his primary goals is to see everybody come to a knowledge of Jesus Christ as their Savior. So I would be misrepresenting if I said it didn't. It sure does, but it does mm-hmm. it so in such a way that, you know, it's not out in your face, but more so he lives it through his life, you know.
I see. Well, that's, you know, I find, in my opinion, that's the essence of Christianity is to live it.
Yeah.
You know, by their works they shall be known and all that. But
yes.
I'm curious, the news release that we got from you, from your bookers, you know, the folks who are trying to get you on radio shows and TV and whatnot, suggest that without religion, morality is not possible. And I'm curious if without religion, without revealed religion, that is, you know, religions where God spoke to somebody and then that somebody came along and said, here's what God said. I'm curious, if that's the case, how did the human race make it this far? How did we survive all these years?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, as Christians, we probably agree without Christ, morality isn't possible. You know, I mean, I don't know about you, but my relationship with Christ is utmost. And, in John 15:5, it says, he's the vine, we're the branches, and he who abides in him bears much fruit, for without me you can do nothing.
So I don't disagree with that basic premise, but I also don't need, you know, and speaking as a Christian, I know, you know, long before I read the Ten Commandments, I knew it was wrong to kill.
Right, right. And I think that comes with our conscience, you know, that God-given conscience, you know.
Well, so what part of morality do we need religion for? And again, let me just say right up front, I'm not an opponent of religion. You know, I consider myself a religious person. But why try to make the argument? I mean, the argument that I make in favor of religion is that it meets a fundamental human need, that there is, the, you know, built into us the ability to experience the divine, the extraordinary. For some people, it's looking up at the night sky and just going, oh, you know, for some people, they find it in nature. For some people, they find it in a particular religion. For some people, they find it in prayer. For some people, they find it in relationships. And some people tragically find that need met in distorted ways through the abuse of drugs or you know, getting lost in our modern culture. But the thing that I don't get is why any particular revealed religion is necessary for morality.
Okay, and I want to tip off that with a scripture in Psalms. It says in Psalm 103:11, for as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his love for those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far as he removed our transgressions from us. We serve such a God of love, and we've been thinking about the theme of love with the movie of Brokeback Mountain, which, of course, I'm dead set against because of the morality issue there. But you know, Tom, I think to answer your question, it's such a I think we need to differentiate between. In fact, I think the Lord is doing that in this day and age between a Christian who is a Christian in name only versus a Christian who has been born again and one who has said, "I surrender all to you, Lord." And I think as far as morality goes, and I think you mentioned the Ten Commandments, and my goodness, what an awesome thing you mentioned. You know, we've got to get back to that in our country, the Ten Commandments. You know, that's one of the main things.
So you think that we should be stoning children to death for speaking ill of their parents?
Whoa, where did that come from?
It's in Deuteronomy. I'm assuming you've read the Bible.
Oh, I got you, yeah.
It's right there in the Ten Commandments.
Right, right. And I think that would, you know, of course be inappropriate. I mean, you know...
Then you're opposed to the Ten Commandments.
Well, I think, you know, when you look at the Levitical laws, you know, and Jesus did say that he came to fulfill the law, and I see what you're saying. You know, we live in a different time and age, and yet Jesus Christ...
Well, what I'm saying is it sounds to me like, you know, you're trying to have it two ways. You know, for example, you were talking about homosexuality. I don't recall, and I really and truly, Don, have read the entire Bible four times in my life, and you know, I'm not just talking off the top of my head here. I don't find any reference to homosexuality in the words of Jesus in the New Testament, and the references that I find to it in the Old Testament are nowhere near as severe as the penalties that are prescribed for people who, for example, wear clothing made out of two different kinds of fabric or who eat shellfish.
Well, I know you know in Leviticus that it says that, you know, homosexuality is an abomination to the Lord, and again in Isaiah it says that as well, and yeah, in Matthew Jesus.
And it's an abomination to the Lord to eat shellfish, and it's an abomination to the Lord to marry somebody of another religion, and it's an abomination to the Lord to bring them in and have them as slaves in your household, and you know, I mean, the list goes on and on. There's over 600 specific in Leviticus. There's over 600 specific instructions, many of which carry the death penalty that go way beyond the Ten Commandments.
Correct.
And homosexual behavior is included in that lump. Why just pick out that one? Why not go on a crusade against people wearing Dacron and cotton?
Well, you know, there you go. And you know, the thing,
because that's illegal according to the Bible.
You know, Corinthians does say that we know in part and we prophesy in part, and when that which has come, you know, one of the things I don't want anybody to misunderstand with me is I'm not coming out against everybody. I feel Jesus said it best when he said in John 15, this is my command, love one another, you know, and we'll only know, Tom, you know, when he returns. But at the same time, I like what you're saying about let's search the scriptures and to see which things are
so. So Don, if loving one another is the essence of certainly the New Testament, and I think that we agree on that. You know, Jesus, mm-hmm. This is his highest commandment.
Oh, absolutely.
And if somebody is born gay, and that's, I think that's probably the essence of the debate or the disagreement. But we see it in the animal kingdom. You find, you know, right across the line among mammals, which we are one. You know, anywhere from 3 to 8% of mammals will be gay. I mean, it's just, they are. So if somebody is born gay and they are in love with somebody and they're having a long-term monogamous relationship, isn't that far more consistent with biblical teaching than living in agony or not having loving relationships?
Well, I would say that a person isn't born gay, but they're raised gay, and let me clarify there. When my own testimony is I have two friends, one who is a previous gay person and one who is a current gay person, and the one that's a delivered gay person obviously had some inclinations and things growing up and different things, but I think the scripture is very specific about homosexuality. I know a lot of people disagree with me on this, but, you know, if God lists it as an abomination, and you mentioned a lot of the things in Deuteronomy, and they are abominations as well, but Leviticus is very specific, in, as you know, the story of Lot, too, and Sodom and different things, that burning in one's heart for the opposite sex is an abomination to the Lord.
Well, you mentioned Lot. I mean, are you mentioning Lot as a paragon of I mean, you realize, of course, that Lot offered those strangers his two daughters,
right,
who were virgins. And then when he left and his wife turned around and turned to a pillar of stone, he went off and he slept with his two daughters and produced children by them, which mm-hmm. became part of the lineage of David that ultimately led to Jesus. I mean, the Bible is not without some strange behaviors in there.
Right, correct. And, you know, I wouldn't list him as a paragon, but I would list him as one that, you know, came back to the Lord, if I'm remembering my scripture correctly, Tom, you know, who was seeking, and like David, who had a looking for a heart for the Lord. If I remember correctly, he's one of the ones that didn't look back and was, you know, went on, and as Philippians says, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. But, yes.
But you know, he never renounced incest.
Yeah, you know, it's things like that, you know. You know, I have no idea. No idea where, you know, if he ended up...
In the Penguin movie, for example, you know, we find now that penguins are gay. That if a female penguin dies and there's an egg, two male penguins will take care of it, and they behave towards each other affectionately. I mean, this is penguin world.
I believe, you know, this is my belief. I believe that the Lord created us with a love for the opposite sex. I believe that those who are gay are gay.
No, I think it created you and me with that love. For the opposite sex.
Well, I think, you know, maybe they came up in a family that was more inclined towards femininity or towards the same sex, you know, and you bring up an excellent point, because if I was brought up in a family that was gay, for example,
I don't think it has anything to do with the family. One of my grandfather's brothers was gay, and you know, that family, I mean, you know, it's just, that's just the way he was from birth.
Yeah, I can't buy that, respectfully. I think that, you know, God gave us our conscience.
Well, this is probably the crux of the disagreement. Anyway, Don Alexander, an interesting conversation. Darnia's Quest, the book, darniasquest.com, the website. Don, good talking with you today.
You too. God bless.
Ditto. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run. Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Morality. Do we need religion to have morality? In my opinion, no. This is another thing that I think probably separates me from fundamentalists of many religions, and that is that I believe that humans are inherently good. And we don't need somebody telling us what some deity told them about how we should live in order to conduct ourselves well. And that those among us who misbehave are the aberrations, are the exception to the rule. And I suspect that they believe that we are not just that, you know, we ought for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory, blah, 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 but that we're all essentially evil. And therefore, we have to have, you know, powerful forces in our lives that restrain our behavior. And I just don't buy it. I think the natural impulse of humans is to be good. And if it weren't, I don't think the human race would have survived 160,000 years. Or, you know, if you want to be a biblical literalist, 5 or 10,000 years, you simply wouldn't have made it. And speaking of real morality, this month, in April of 1953, Dwight Eisenhower gave a speech in which he talked about real morality. Here is a Republican president of the United States speaking of what is moral and important.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft.
A theft. Every warship launched, every gun that is made signifies, in the final sense, a theft from whom?
From those who hunger and are not fed. Those who are cold and are not clothed.
He continues to talk about the giant war machine, the world prepared for war. And keep in mind, this is 1953. There, I believe that by that time the Korean conflict had been resolved. There was no war, but the world at Cold War. He said, we're not just spending money. There is a very real cost for a battleship. There is a very real cost for a tank. And here, a man who should know. I mean, he was the supreme Allied commander during World War II. A man who devoted his life to the business of fighting wars. President Dwight D. Eisenhower. The true cost of war.
This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this.
Now, get this. The cost of one modern heavy bomber.
a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement.
Eisenhower laying out what we could have bought if we didn't buy that one piece of military hardware. He continues.
We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is, I repeat, the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Humanity hanging from a cross of iron. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Lauren in Essex, Vermont. Hey, Lauren, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Well, it's really exciting to talk to you.
Well, and thank you for listening to WVAA there in Burlington.
That's right. I love your show.
Thank you. What's up?
Well, I really like that the last segment. I thought you're arguing. You're really polite to everybody, and you let everybody have a chance to talk. And your knowledge of the Bible really revealed that this man isn't grounded in the Bible. It's really about a belief that he has that he can't substantiate. That is, that people are born homosexual.
Right. Well, this is the fundamental. With so many of these issues, they always boil down to really one fundamental issue. For example, with the abortion issue, are 4 cells a baby? You know,
right.
People can reasonably disagree on that.
It's a philosophical issue. It's not in the Bible anywhere.
That's right. Absolutely. With regard to abortion, with regard to homosexuality, frankly, I think, the science is pretty irrefutable now that people are born, that some people are born gay. Certainly we know right across the animal kingdom, it is a relatively normal thing.
Well, I thought it was really restrained of you not to say, boy, does Dick Cheney's family seem like a feminist or feminized kind of, if you grew up in a feminized environment,
right. Yeah.
You'd be gay. I mean,
well, I don't like to pick on people, and Mary Cheney is, I admire her for being out,
But it's just the ridiculous nature of the argument that you can elicit this from people without getting nasty and calling names and just being knowledgeable about what you're speaking about. I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Lauren. Thank you for your kind words and for listening, and be sure to patronize our sponsors.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Hey! And welcome back, my friends. 1,021 days. 1,021 days, 12 hours, 27 minutes, 2 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office. Now, it's assuming that there are no interventions on the part of, for example, the House of Representatives with an impeachment attempt, which seems to be on the mind of Tom DeLay.
Now, the DeLay Political...
Whoops.
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
There we go. And Tom DeLay, he's announced that he's leaving. He's leaving the House of Representatives, and he adds...
As difficult as this decision has been for me, it's not going to be a great day for liberal Democrats either. My loyalty to the Republican Party, indeed my love for the Republican Party, has played no small part in this decision. Having served under Republican and Democrat control in the House, I know firsthand how important it is for Republicans to maintain their national majority.
Notice, by the way, that he doesn't say Democratic, which is the actual name of the party. He says Democrat.
A Democrat Congress in 2007 would, without doubt or remorse, raise hundreds of billions of dollars in taxes.
What? We might have a balanced budget? We might stop being in debt? We might stop running up the credit card on our children and grandchildren? Oh, we can't have that. After all, the millionaires and billionaires have to have their tax cuts.
summarily cut and run from the war on terror.
What, you might get out of Iraq and stop killing our young people and those of Iraq as well? Oh, gee.
And immediately initiate an unconstitutional impeachment of President Bush.
Unconstitutional impeachment. Now, since the impeachment process is in the Constitution, I don't know how it could be unconstitutional. But anyway, facts never really confuse Tom DeLay, right?
However certain such antics might make a Republican resurgence in 2008, the times are too grave to waste even 2 years in the life of this nation and allow even one more vote for their agenda of pessimism and failure.
There you go. And then we get to the real issue, you know, what's really going on here. And that is that Tom DeLay is going to cash in as a lobbyist. He's going to sell his house in Virginia. He's going to move into Washington, D.C., where he can be close to the action and become a multi-millionaire selling influence, because he certainly has the connections.
I also intend to relocate my Virginia property and reside closer to Washington so that I can dedicate the necessary time and energy to making a successful transition from the public to private sectors for myself and family.
Yeah, assuming that he doesn't go to jail. That's the strategy. Tom DeLay on his way to becoming a millionaire. Gloria in Plano, Texas. Hey, Gloria, thanks for calling the program.
Hi, Tom. I just had a comment in relation to your last segment.
Mm-hmm.
As to the reason why I think people are born gay. And I think it's good now that there's scientific evidence coming forward, but I feel that all you have to do is look at history and look up pretty much across all cultures and all time periods. There's been evidence of people being gay.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty much, you know, how can you say it may be because people grew up in a certain type of family when it's been across all kinds of cultures and families and thousands of years? Just the fact that it's in the Bible tells you that homosexuality existed 2,000 years ago.
Right, yeah, it had to exist for them to trash
it. For them to even, exactly, and probably 4,000, 5,000 years ago. I mean, you know.
Yeah, no, it's been around as long as humans have been
right,
around.
Right, exactly.
It's been around as long as mammals have been around.
Right, and, so you would tend to think it's some kind, you know, it's a natural thing or something that's ingrained and innate to some people.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with you, Gloria, and I think that that's the point of cleavage. And tragically, these guys are hanging on to this belief,
right,
even in the face of scientific evidence,
right,
which,
exactly,
which is just a shame.
Exactly.
Gloria,
that's my comment for today, and hooray about Tom DeLay, but I think you're right. He's going straight to be a lobbyist.
There you go. Straight for the cash.
Yeah,
as soon as
I thought that last night when I heard it. I was like, okay.
There you go. Yep.
All right.
Thanks
thank
a lot, Gloria.
Tom. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, then the other thing, the reason why he has he's resigning in June or July, whenever it is, sometime this summer, is so that Rick Perry, you know, the remnant of the Bush, the George W. Bush machine in Texas, Rick Perry can install a Republican in his place so that that Republican will have 4 months of incumbency without even having, you know, had to be beat up in a primary. He'll have 4 months of incumbency to be able to send out franked letters, you know, free mail to everybody in the district and get on the TV constantly and do press conferences and do talk shows locally and all that local campaigning stuff that a candidate would have a much harder time doing and a much more expensive time doing, frankly. He'll be able to do it for free. So what DeLay is doing is guaranteeing that that House seat is going to remain Republican, or at least doing the best he can to guarantee that. And he probably actually will be successful in that, would be my guess, because he's just getting out of the way. He's realized how toxic he is. Danny in Iowa City, Iowa. Hey, Danny, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Immigration is on my mind. I just have a quick scenario, and I wanted to ask you what you thought about it. It might be crazy, but okay. Say somehow the Republicans get their way and they build a wall or find out a way to keep out all the illegal immigrants from Mexico. Well, you know, as we know, Mexico is kind of like a fetal state. You know, it's just the oppression is terrible, and the Mexican people, the only hope they have really is El Norte, looking northward. Okay, we cut that off. They're going to be cornered. They're going to turn, and they're going to have to face their government and situation. Well, it's pretty much a dictatorship. We know that. You know, in history, time and time again has shown us that the people will rise up against this type of oppression, but in some cases, the people take it to the extreme. For example, a communist state like Russia or China or even Castro. So what if what would it be like to have a communist neighbor down south? I mean, is that just taking it too far? I'd like to hear what you think about that. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's pretty unlikely, Danny. You know, there actually is right now. Vicente Fox has an opponent in the election that's coming up in June or July, whenever the elections in Mexico are. And the guy is more of a populist. What we're seeing, the direction that we're seeing, much of South America, certainly, we've just seen it in Chile, to some extent in Argentina, certainly in Bolivia, in Venezuela, the directions that we're seeing are people moving in the direction of basically being populists, democratic populists. That is to say, they are, you know, working with the people to try to accomplish the will of the people, you know, to build a society that is fairer for everybody. Mexico's problem is oligarchy. Mexico's problem is that there's a very small number of very, very powerful and wealthy families who basically own the country. And until that is broken up, whether it's through inheritance laws or whether it's through, you know, progressive taxation or what, you know, I don't know how it will be broken up. But until that's broken up, that's the problem that they're going to face. And the reality is that every democratic country, every democracy in the world has come about, at least by and large, I shouldn't say absolutely every, but the vast majority of democratic countries in the world have come about as a result of the people rising up and saying, you know, we want a democracy. We're going to build a democracy. And I suspect that if Mexico wasn't able to export their social pressures to the United States, I mean, we're supplying them with $17 billion a year in foreign aid in the form of repatriated money from illegal workers here in the United States. And also it's a steam release, a pressure release, a release valve, you know, being able to cross the border and come here. I suspect if that didn't exist, that the people of Mexico would, as you say, have to face the problem. And I would hope, and I suspect, that they would face that problem in a reasonable fashion. Pat in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Pat, what's on your mind?
Tom, great show. The Tom DeLay deal. What I heard this morning on C-SPAN was one of the reasons he may be getting out now is because he can use the re-election campaign funds
for his legal defense fund.
Exactly. I think that's outrageous that he could do something like that.
Well, I think that's the reason why he got out now instead of before the primary, because during the primary he raised a lot more money than he spent.
Yes.
And so now he's got, you know, several millions of dollars, my understanding is, in his campaign war chest, and he can use that. Once you're no longer running for office, there's these strange rules in the House of Representatives. You can actually use that money personally.
Yes.
And there are some restrictions on it, but not many. And he certainly can use it for his legal defense. Although I suspect that he'll probably use it to open his lobbying business, and he's got lots of good friends who will help out with his legal defense. But
that could be also. I also got a kick out of the fact that he had a person there in his little speech about the Democrats and all this, and you know, negative about the Democrats, which reminded me of the time he had to report into the sheriff's office in Texas, where he had a big smile on his face.
Mm.
I think that's all going to come back and bite him really hard on his ass when reality hits him. Hopefully, they might give him a few years.
Well, just to give credit where credit's due, that smile was a pretty smart trick on his part, actually, because he knew that a mugshot is in the public domain. You know, it's a public document. And so he knew that was going to be picked up by newspapers and media all over the country, all over the world. And so he did something very smart politically, you know, putting that big smile on his face. I don't think he was trying to say that he was happy to be arrested.
Oh, no, that's not what I meant. I meant what he was trying to do with that big smile also is also stick it to the Democrats.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You can't see, you're not bothering me at all. That was his point. You know, you're not hurting me with this. And I think all that's going to come back and really get him hard within probably 6 months from now or so.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
Hopefully.
it's probably going to be in a court of law that we'll find out, you know, what happens ultimately to Tom DeLay.
We can only hope.
Yeah, there you go. Pat, thanks a lot, Tom, for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Oh, my. Well, we'll see how it shakes out. It's an eventful day in Washington, D.C., certainly an eventful day. Helping you win the water cooler wars. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, or coming up on it. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Over in the chat room discussion, well, actually, this is interesting. Blue in Missouri notes the House of Representatives is voting on what right now on what to do with 507s. Yeah, good luck. Like the Republicans are going to do anything that actually represents true campaign change. Somehow I doubt it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Ann in Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Ann, welcome to the program.
Hi, I listen most of the time, don't usually get time to call in. I want to tell you how much I enjoy your show.
Well, thank you.
The reason I'm calling is because I am in Florida. A lot of this discussion about the illegal immigrants does impact me directly.
Sure.
Because our state, we have a lot of migrant workers in our area, and a lot of them are on the local welfare rolls and health care rolls and school, and, you know, it does impact us that live here and work here. What I find real interesting was something I read this morning regarding all of these illegal immigrants and all these demonstrations that are going on across the country, because they are very well organized, no matter what they're trying to tell you. Well, what I was reading is that they've been running ads and things for those demonstrations on the Spanish-speaking television and radio networks.
Right.
And what someone did was trace back who owns those stations, and I found out that a majority of them are actually owned by General Electric. Now, we know General Electric is very good at censoring news they don't want on TV, such as when they were having protests against the war in Iraq, et cetera.
Right. That's when GE, which owns MSNBC, took Phil Donahue off the air, even though he was the most highly rated and only profitable program on MSNBC at the time.
Exactly. So we all have to question, why are they allowing all of this to be appear on these Spanish-speaking stations to encourage all of this demonstration?
Yeah, it's,
get all these people out there. I smell a plot, don't you?
That's interesting. Well, you know, I don't know. It may well be, but maybe not for the reason that you think, Ann. Just from inside radio, okay? I do a morning program before I do this national program on a radio station in Portland, Oregon, KPOJ. It's a 25,000-watt station. It reaches much of the Pacific Northwest, and it's owned by Clear Channel. Clear Channel also distributes about 80% of all the people who listen to progressive talk radio in the United States are listening on a Clear Channel station. And yet, Lowry Mays, I believe, is the president. I think that the Mays family is the second. I may be wrong on this. It might be third or fourth.
there's a lot of this stuff that doesn't add up in your official version, and we'd like to know more. Mm. By the way, they did censor that one, and that got stopped. But there's a lot of other things going on that are being ignored because they've got everybody's attention on this, and not that it's not a big issue, because it is, especially if you're living in one of the states that's heavily populated by illegal immigrants.
But you know, in defense of the mainstream media, which I do cringing, okay, but in defense of them, I would say, you know, the anti-war demonstrations, I mean, were well covered back in 2002 when we had the largest demonstrations in the history of the world, people out on the streets. They really were well covered and were well known. The demonstrations that are happening now tend to be relatively small, and I think in the minds of a lot of people in the media, it's more of the same. You know, yes, there's people out there demonstrating. You know, there's always going to be people out there demonstrating. But when a million people show up on the streets, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it's never happened before. That is news. You know, it's a hot story. So, Ann? Nope. I guess Ann is gone. But, yep, she heard the music. And, I'm not yet convinced, let's put it that way, that there's a nefarious agenda at work here. But I wouldn't rule it out. Absolutely wouldn't rule it out. So we'll carry on from there. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, the Tom Hartman radio program. Progressive talk radio. Mark Manning is with us, conceptionmedia.net, his website. Mark is a documentarist presenting Caught in the Crossfire, a new documentary, The Untold Story of Fallujah, conceptionmedia.net. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
What is the untold story of Fallujah, Mark?
Well, pretty much what happened to the civilians there was not told to the American people. There were 250,000 civilians that were in that city.
This is a city about the size of Cincinnati, Ohio.
That's correct. And in November 2004, the city was sieged by the American military. And the civilians were forced out, but they were given nowhere to go. And up to 20% were left inside the city, so up to 50,000 civilians were left inside that city. And what happened to them is unknown. The civilians that left inside the city, the ones that were forced out, they were given nowhere to go, no shelter, no food, no water. They were living out in the desert, in holes in the ground, in chicken coops, and it was a humanitarian disaster created by American policy in Iraq that didn't get back to the American people, and I'm trying to bring that back through this documentary.
Was Fallujah primarily a Shiite or Sunni town?
It was predominantly a Sunni town. It's called the City of Mosques. It's a very religious and spiritual city. It's an ancient city. It goes back beyond the history of Iraq and through the bloodlines of the Middle East. So when that city was destroyed, it really created quite a event for the people of the Middle East. There's folk songs that are written about it now. There's pamphlets throughout the Middle East about the mosques that were destroyed and the people that were destroyed there. It's a very well-known incident throughout the Middle East, and it has a lot to do with the explosion of the insurgency in Iraq and American troops dying on a daily basis there now.
Why is this not widely known in the United States that a lot of the it sounds like, let me just rephrase what I thought I heard you just say, and you tell me if I got it right. A lot of the Sunni part of the insurgency against the American occupiers is out of rage or revenge or retaliation as a direct consequence of what we did in Fallujah, which my understanding is we did in retaliation for what happened to those four contractors.
Right. I think you got what I said right. Our policy was to go into Fallujah and, quote, break the backs of the insurgency, and it had the opposite effect. The insurgency in Iraq is predominantly Iraqi civilians and former army people who are fighting the Americans, but it's predominantly Iraqis. And when we destroyed an ancient and holy city and destroyed the lives of 250,000 civilians, the hatred that spurred from that event continues to be a fueling source for the insurgency in Iraq. And not only that, but Fallujah, the policy of Fallujah of emptying out a city and then destroying it and giving no aid and care to the civilians has now become a policy of the American military in Iraq. And that Fallujah has been replicated throughout western Iraq in cities like Haditha, Rawa, and Al-Qaim, and other places in western Iraq. And the civilians are being dumped out into the desert. No aid is given to them. Their cities are destroyed. Anybody left inside the city is killed. And that is not doing any good for the hatred against America.
Now, I suppose you could argue in the most Machiavellian of worlds that Saddam Hussein ruled Iraq with an iron fist. People were terrified of him. He would kill people, you know, if they spoke out against him. And therefore, you know, in some warped way, some military genius, you know, the Pentagon, Don Rumsfeld or somebody might think, I use the word genius sarcastically, might think that the way to dominate Iraq is to terrify Iraq because it worked for Saddam. Why can't it work for us? But after the experience of even one or two of these cities having it not work for us, in fact, having it blow back at us, why are we continuing this policy?
You know, I wish I could answer that question. I can't put my mind into the minds of people that make this kind of policy. I can answer that question from the Iraqis' point of view that I asked, and what they told me is that this is a policy that is exactly working. It's meant to create chaos. It's meant to create violence, because a united and peaceful Iraq, the very first thing they would do is ask the Americans to leave. So the only way the Americans can stay is if there's violence and chaos and civil war in Iraq. And the Iraqis believe that this is a policy that's being implemented by our actions there, and we are spurning the violence and fueling the insurgency and fueling the civil war.
Well, it's interesting. You know, in 1999, George W. Bush told Mickey Herskowitz, his biographer, who was at that time writing, ghostwriting the autobiography, Bush's autobiography, A Charge to Keep, told him that his father's biggest mistake was making the Iraq war so short in 1991, and that if he had continued the war up to the election, he would have won the election, but he ended the war too quickly. Bush certainly isn't making that mistake.
No, and I guess he said he doesn't have plans to leave during his presidency.
Right, yeah, he's pretty clear about that. So why, we're talking with Mark Manning, the website conceptionmedia.net. Mark has created a new documentary, Caught in the Crossfire. How can people find, see, rent, buy, whatever, this documentary, Mark?
We're distributing it off of our website at conceptionmedia.net. And also, when people buy this DVD at conceptionmedia.net, that 25% of the proceeds are going back into Iraq to Iraq relief. And that's another story that I don't think the American people know, that all the relief agencies have pulled out of Iraq because of the chaos there. And that chaos really resulted from the disbanding of all of their military and police forces.
Right.
But because of that, only a few Iraqi agencies and individual citizens are doing the relief work in Iraq, and we were in contact with them. I actually helped them bring aid into Fallujah, and through our contacts with them, we are sending them money so that they can purchase basic human need supplies for these combat zones. They take blankets in, they take Pampers and diapers in, they take baby formula, and it ends up being the only aid that gets into these combat zones. And we'll continue to support them for as long as it's needed.
Mark Manning, conceptionmedia.net, the new movie Caught in the Crossfire, the untold story of Fallujah, the new documentary. You can get it at the conceptionmedia.net. Mark, you said that the United States, people in the United States, are largely unaware of what happened in Fallujah. Number one, why? And number two, is that also true of people in Europe, people in Asia, people in other countries around the world that have access to mass media? Is this something that is just widely known outside of Iraq, or is this something that basically there's just been a news blackout on in the United States?
You know, I think that's a great question. That is the question of the war. Why is this not happening? Fallujah is an hour's drive from the Green Zone. It's less than 45 minutes from Baghdad. And the Green Zone is where all of the corporate media headquarters are. So it's not like it's a hard place to get to. Why that story isn't being told, why we were told here 250,000 civilians are all okay, they're living with their relatives, when exactly they were actually dying out in the dirt, I don't know why that story isn't. That's a corporate decision that's made on the corporate levels of places like CNN and Fox News. And then outside of this country, it's much more...
So let me just interrupt you for a second, Mark. Yeah. Another possible explanation, and I'm not putting this forward as I'm not advocating for this, but you said, you know, it's 45 minutes away from the Green Zone, therefore it's not that hard to get there. But, you know, from what I've talked to several people who've lived in the Green Zone, and literally walking one block away from the Green Zone is putting your life at risk.
Absolutely.
And I've been in parts of the world where that's, you know, you go from safe to not safe by crossing a street. And so to say that just because it's 45 minutes away, it's easy to get to is a little disingenuous. Maybe it's just that nobody's been willing to go there to report. You know, we've had more reporters killed in Iraq than we did in Vietnam.
Yes, and I'd have to go back to the question of why did that happen. And when you started with shock and awe, the very first days of the war, where were the reports there of civilian casualties?
Right.
Where were all the reports at the beginning of the war, before it became dangerous, of civilian casualties? And the Iraqi people began to look at the media as part of the occupation.
Mm.
And that's why it's become so dangerous to report in Iraq now, because reporters are no longer trusted. They certainly were at the beginning of the war. They had free range. They were on the streets and not reporting the civilian casualties. And I'm not saying it's the individual reporters, because I have talked to individual embedded reporters who yeah. are taking those pictures, who are doing those reports. And it doesn't get through the filter process to get to the American people. There's a corporate-level decision, and that's what I meant by that.
I see.
And it is dangerous now. You're absolutely right. But the question is, why is it so dangerous? And it's because we are not reporting the truth from Iraq.
Brilliant, brilliant. Mark Manning, he's the documentarist, put together Caught in the Crossfire, documentary, The Untold Story of Fallujah, conceptionmedia.net. Check it out. Mark, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And for the great work you're doing. Keep it up. It's 16 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. smalldog.com, their website, and Eco Wine, the organic wine company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, ECOWINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE, for fine imported French organic wines. The madness never seems to end. It's time now for a Limbo Alert.
Condescending crimes, making money, selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts. I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic guts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this. They always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
That's right. I really am, because I'm a Nazi. That's right.
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
Indeed, the theme music for our Limbaugh alert, and here it is, Rush Limbaugh calling the rape victim at Duke University a hoe.
Duke, with a lacrosse team, supposedly raped some hoes. Hello, AB, great to have you with us.
Rush, did you just call those young ladies hoes on the nationally syndicated program? Do you know something about them that perhaps we don't know?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. Well, you know, Limbaugh, he's well-adjusted to society, shall we say. He's well-adjusted. And it's just, well, on this day in history, speaking of well-adjusted, on this day in history, Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. And Dr. Martin Luther King had some thoughts about being well-adjusted and its opposite, being maladjusted. And I think rather than buying into the, being a part of the culture thing that Limbaugh is promoting, Dr. King would have said something quite different. In fact, here's comments he made in the year before he was assassinated.
Modern psychology has a word that is probably used more than any other word in psychology. It is the word maladjusted. It is the ringing cry of modern child psychology, maladjusted. Now, of course, we all want to live the well-adjusted life in order to avoid neurotic and schizophrenic personalities. But as I move toward my conclusion, I would like to say to you today, in a very honest manner, that there are some things in our society and some things in our world which I'm proud to be maladjusted. And I call upon all men of goodwill to be maladjusted to these things until the good society is realized. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to racial segregation and discrimination. I never intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few, leave millions of God's children smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society.
And I have a feeling Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would never have adjusted himself to referring to women, particularly rape victims, as hoes. As predicted, the Supreme Court... to change topics here. As predicted, the Supreme Court has backed away from deciding whether or not Jose Padilla, how he prefers his name be pronounced, P-A-D-I-L-L-A, Jose Padilla, could have been held as an enemy combatant in Guantanamo, or in the military brig in South Carolina, I guess is where he was being held. And at the time, you will recall, those of you who are regular listeners to the program will recall that when the federal government, when Ashcroft, well, actually it was Gonzalez, when Gonzalez charged Padilla with a federal crime, which had nothing to do with terrorism, had nothing to do with 9/11, had nothing to do with the assertion that he was going to make a dirty bomb because he'd been surfing the web and they found on his computer that he was surfing the web looking for dirty bomb information, none of that. He was not charged with any of the crimes that were fed to the media and for which he was held those 3 years. I said at the time, the reason why the Bush administration is now charging him with an actual crime, which is what the law requires. The habeas corpus requires that, you know, and the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments of the Constitution very clearly require that you be charged with a crime, that you have access to a defense, that you be brought before a jury of your peers, that you have the ability to make bail, just, you know, very straightforward. That the reason the Bush administration did this was because the Supreme Court would no longer have standing. They wouldn't be able to rule on whether or not Bush's decree that he can put anybody he damn well pleases in jail with no reason whatsoever other than that he says so and maybe they're a terrorist or an enemy combatant. He didn't want that to go before the Supreme Court. And so he charged Padilla with an actual crime. And sure enough, the Supreme Court today said, well, we can't rule on it now because he's not in detention any longer.
This is the The Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And what was the name of this ill-fated ship? And where did she go on her ill-fated trip? Guam and oil from Africa never thinks twice. The name of the ship, Condoleezza Rice. And the name of the ship, Condoleezza Rice.
You'll recall there actually was an oil tanker, a Chevron oil tanker, named after one of the members of the board of directors of Chevron, called the Condoleezza Rice. Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. As I was mentioning, this is worth just digging into a little bit more. The Supreme Court, this Stephen Henderson writing the Knight Ridder News Service, the Supreme Court refused yesterday to decide whether the president can detain Americans classified as enemy combatants indefinitely and without charges, saying the issue is now irrelevant to the case of terrorism suspect Jose Padilla. It was a 6-3 vote. The three dissenters, by the way, were Ginsburg, Souter, and Breyer. And in the 6-3 vote, the justices said that although Padilla has been held for more than 3 years in legal limbo in a military brig, he has now been charged with criminal conspiracy and is awaiting trial in a Florida prison. Any effort to reconsider his military detention would be, quote, hypothetical and to no effect at this stage, end quote, Justice Anthony Kennedy explained in an unusual written opinion concerning a refusal to hear the case. He says, if the court were to rule in Padilla's favor, his president custody status would be unchanged. See, this is the thing. I said this at the time. Everybody thought that the court would rule on whether or not it was legal for George W. Bush to violate the Constitution, to break the law of the United States, and throw people in jail with no charges, and simply because he says he can. Because he's King George. And if people are, oh, yeah, Supreme Court, they're going to take that case. Nothing to worry. And I'm saying, no, they won't. Because Bush is going to pull a rabbit out of the hat. And he did. Just before the initial arguments, they charged Padilla with criminal conspiracy. And so now he's charged with something. And so, you know, now the case doesn't have standing, at least in the minds of 6 out of the 9 justices. Now, 3 of the justices said, nonetheless, we should take this case, even though it won't change anything for Padilla, just to discuss the precedent. Obviously, those 3 were not happy. They did not want to support George W. Bush. But we've got, you know, basically a Bush court. I mean, we've got a Reagan-Bush-Reagan court. And, you know, a couple of appointees from Bill Clinton, who, by the way, both of them, Ginsburg and Breyer, both of them were names that were given to Bill Clinton by Orrin Hatch. Nothing the government has done purports to retract the assertion of executive power Padilla protests, said Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the dissent. In other words, you know, the government hasn't stopped doing this. They've just stopped doing it against Padilla. So we still should look at this case, she's saying. And she says nothing prevents Bush from returning him to military custody or reclassifying him as a combatant. Kennedy, Justice Kennedy, who voted not to take the case, said that if Bush throw Padilla back in the brig, then they should act promptly, in quotes. Monday marks the second time, by the way, Padilla had struck out on procedural grounds at the Supreme Court. In 2004, the justices ruled that he'd filed the original challenge to his detention in the wrong court without saying whether his captivity is justified. So here we have the Supreme Court just, you know, dancing around this thing, trying to stay away from it. They just don't want to take the case on, as I predicted. I hate it when I'm right about things like that. Anyway, it's a shame. At the same time, the Pentagon is planning an online information war. Get this. This is incredible. The Sunday Herald. Imagine a world where wars are fought over the Internet, where TV broadcasts and newspaper reports are designed by the military to confuse the population, and where a foreign armed power can shut down your computer, phone, radio, or TV at will. In 2006, writes Neil McKay in the Sunday Morning Herald, this the big Australian paper. In 2006, he says, we are about to enter such a world. This is the age of information warfare, and details of how this new military doctrine will affect everyone on the planet are in this new report that Don Rumsfeld commissioned and approved, called the Information Operations Roadmap. The Pentagon has already signed off on $383 million to force through the document's recommendations by 2009. They call this a revolution in the concept of warfare. It is going to give the United States military the ability to shut down anybody's telephone, anybody's television, anybody's radio access, anybody's internet access, to shut down websites, to shut down entire parts of the country or other countries. As they note in the Sunday Herald, freedom of speech advocates are horrified at this new doctrine, but military planners and members of the intelligence community embrace the idea as a necessary development in modern combat. They further note, this revolution in information warfare is merely an extension of the politics of the neoconservative Bush White House. Even before getting into power, key players in Team Bush were planning total military and political domination of the globe. In September, now this sounds hyperbolic, but it's not. In September 2000, the now notorious document Rebuilding America's Defenses, written by the Project for a New American Century, PNAC, a think tank staffed by some of the Bush presidency's leading lights, including Rumsfeld, Feith, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Cheney, and Jeb Bush, said that America needed, quote, a blueprint for maintaining U.S. global preeminence, precluding the rise of a great rival power, and shaping the international security order in line with American principles and interests. The U.S. wants to take control of the Earth's electromagnetic spectrum, allowing U.S. war planners to dominate mobile phones, PDAs, the web, radio, TV, and other forms of modern communication. That could see entire countries denied access to communications by the flick of a switch in the United States. And you know, I think a lot of people in the United States are concerned that you could see entire parts of the United States shut down electronically by the flip of a switch. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Alice in Humboldt County, California on the line, listening on KGOE. Hey, Alice.
Well, I know that I've had my TV blocked.
Mm-hmm.
And others have, too. And that's scary.
Yeah, well, I think at the national level, we all have. We've seen, you know, these reporters who are afraid to cover stories because they're afraid to lose their six-figure salaries or seven-figure salaries. And we're, you know, we see, you know, Bill Maher lost his TV show. Phil Donahue lost his TV show. I mean, you know, even right, they're just right up front about it. It's obvious about it.
Well, it's scary.
Mm.
I have to start my little deal here.
Okay.
I have lived through Harding and Coolidge and Hoover, but our country has never been in such danger as now. The big threat is that they are still hanging on to their crooked voting machines. Do you think it might be a good thing that Hugo Chavez has bought the Sequoia company? He doesn't like the neocons.
Yeah. Well, actually, Chavez hasn't bought Sequoia. It's two or three Venezuelan businessmen. And Sequoia is one of the three largest voting machine vendors in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been bought by Venezuelan nationals. And there's a lot of concern down in Venezuela. The Venezuelan equivalent of Republicans, the right-wingers, are all freaked out because these voting machines are in the hands of these guys. And they say that Chavez is going to be rigging elections using electronic voting machines. And so the conservatives in Venezuela are opposed to the use of electronic voting machines. Here in the United States, of course, the conservatives won't even allow a bill to come to the floor to be debated on. But whether these businessmen in Venezuela are really in line with Chavez, or whether they would even, for that matter, consider tinkering with the elections of the United States, Alice, in my mind, is doubtful. My bigger concern is just that this is a technology. Number one, it's a technology that's not ready for prime time. All of these machines, I don't think it's possible to make a computerized machine that can't be hacked. And secondly, you know, we should not have private corporations, whether they're owned by Americans or Venezuelans, handling our vote. Don't you agree?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think that that's the core issue when you get right down to it. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. And it may really freak out a few Republicans when they get it that Venezuelans and, you know, Hugo Chavez, the head of Venezuela, that Venezuelans own our voting own some of our voting machines. But so far, they haven't spoken up. So we'll see how that shakes out, too. Alice, thank you for the call.
Okay.
Always marvelous to hear from you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Good talking with you. And we're going to take a break here in just a second. We'll be coming back with your phone calls. But the core issue with regard to the voting machines is one that just cannot be emphasized too often, and that is that of all the commons, you know, our national forests, our roads, our police departments, our fire departments, of all the commons, the most vital of all of them is our vote, because that's the commons by which we administer all the rest of the commons. And privatizing the vote was insane. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We can be strong and do.
Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Stephen in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Stephen, what's up?
Hi, Tom, my hero. How are you doing?
Yeah.
I want to get back to illegal labor and corporate America's addiction to it.
Yes.
And I have a little bit of experience in this. I used to be a recruiter for one of these staffing agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked at a manufacturing plant here in Georgia. I won't say which. But I hired about five illegals for every – actually, I hired an illegal for about five – every five citizens who came in looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
And these people just would not hire, you know, USA citizens because – they said they didn't work as well, and this, they paid them the same, and they kept some of them on, but at the same time, you know, it was...
What year was
the
this?
The amount of people I turned away.
What year was this, Stephen?
It was about 2 years ago.
Huh, interesting, because back in 1987, I owned an ad agency in Atlanta, and we had to hire, we were looking for somebody... who we had a client who was doing a newsletter in multiple languages, and I needed somebody who was an artist, a graphic designer, who also had the ability to speak and read and can proofread, you know, good language competence in Spanish, English, and Japanese, and which sounds like something impossible. We actually put an ad in the paper in Atlanta, and we found this guy. His name was Shinji. I don't want to put his last name out, and Shin worked for us for several years. And his parents were Japanese. He was born in Peru. His parents spoke Japanese. He learned Japanese from his parents. He learned Spanish living in Peru. And he came to the United States when he was about 9 or 10 years old and learned English in the United States. His English was virtually accent-free. His Spanish was accent-free. And his Japanese was totally fluent. But he was not a U.S. citizen. And he was here, his parents were working, but he was here on some kind of visitor visa or whatever. And I had to jump through at least 3 months of song and dance with the Internal Revenue Service to get a visa so that I could hire this guy. And I had a real job that I couldn't find an American to do. And it wasn't, you know, a matter of not being able to pay for it. It was just this very rare collection of skills. And that's what the H-1B visas are designed for. And I, you know, I went through it. I mean, I was the employer. I owned the company. And I just, you know, the idea that other companies in Atlanta are hiring and just saying, oh, it doesn't matter. I mean, it just boggles my mind. I had the impression that I would have gone to jail if I didn't go through all that stuff with Shin.
Yeah, that's part of my question is, I know you said many times that the way to quote-unquote cure the oversaturation problem with illegals is to arrest the CEO and they'll all start heading back to the border because we won't pay them anymore, and who's going to stick around here if they don't get paid?
Right.
But my question, it goes a little further than that, is who is it that's responsible, who would it be who would arrest the CEO? What government agency is dropping the ball currently?
Well, it used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which is now part of the Department of Homeland Security. But, I mean, the easy way to track this, frankly, is through the Internal Revenue Service.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because you have to submit a Social Security number and you know, when you hire somebody. And if that Social Security number comes back, you know, this is a bogus number or five people are using this number or whatever. I mean, and the Social Security Administration knows this. We know who these illegals are. There was an interesting op-ed about this in the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago. And we're just sort of winking and nodding and putting that money in the bank because we know that they won't be able to claim against it for things like Social Security. So they say, well, we're collecting $7 billion in Social Security from illegals that they'll never be able to lay claim to. Yeah, but they're costing us $100 billion a year in medical services we're providing where they show up at hospitals and then, you know, the bill never gets paid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, heaven only knows what it's costing for education and on it goes. But frankly, I think that, you know, the bigger issue that is almost the Republican issue. You know, I'm not so concerned about the cost at that level. I'm concerned about the dilution of our labor force.
Yeah, I'd like to see what you say. I'd like to see a CEO get in trouble. I'd like to see a corporate board get taken to task for doing this. The situation that was going on in the manufacturing plant was it was an outdated facility. It was very dangerous, a lot of accidents. Every single week we about had an accident. And
well, that's why they wanted to hire illegals, because
exactly.
they wouldn't file OSHA claims.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, less OSHA claims.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the work, a lot of Americans would just leave because it was so dangerous. You know,
yeah.
Working with machinery is from the 60s and 70s.
Right, and then you have the question of, you know, should we have third world labor standards in the United States?
Yeah, I called it slavery light.
Yeah, yeah, it's not good. Stephen, thanks for the call and for bringing it up. It's you know, I still think, you know, there is an answer to this, and it's dealing with the employers. Appreciate the call, Bob in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Bob, we just have a minute left before we've got to wrap up the show. What's up?
Tom, wanted to go back to the issue you were on before with corporatocracy taking over the news. I suppose you're aware of, you know, Chris Graff, the pillar of AP News here in the state of Vermont for a long time, getting fired. Rumor because he was one of the guys that took on O'Reilly with the Judge Cashman sexual perpetration issue.
Right.
So, you know, not only is it happening with the guys with the 6- and 7-figure salaries, it's happening on the local level too.
Yeah, with the guys making $30,000-$40,000 a year.
Exactly.
This is big business taking care of itself. I mean, you know, and this is one of the reasons why I think when Howard Dean said, and this is what, of course, destroyed his presidential candidacy when he told Chris Matthews that the first thing he'd do as president if he were elected was break up the big networks.
Yeah,
and say, you know, a media company should only be in the business of owning media and running media. It should not be in the business of manufacturing weapons, you know, as in the case of GE, one of the largest defense contractors, owning NBC. And Chris Matthews would look just absolutely shocked. And that was the week that Dean was on the cover of Newsweek and Time. And he was the fair-haired boy, man. And the day after that interview with Matthews, all you heard on all the media was, Dean's out of control. Dean's gone nuts. Dean's is this, Dean that. And he never again got that good publicity that he had the day before. You know, open mouth, insert foot, I guess. But it really shows what's going on. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. Founded in 1990, Bioneers, a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Bioneers.org, their website. Saturday night, in fact, I was at a Global Green Awards dinner in Los Angeles, where Bioneers founder, co-founders Kenny and Nina, Kenny Ossibel and Nina, I'm forgetting her last name, his wife, were one of the five folks who won these awards. And Ed Begley Jr. got up and gave a whole big thing, and it was a hoot. But anyhow, that's our Bioneers segment for the day. Our Bioneers guest today, Zipporah Berman, the program director for Forest Ethics, forestethics.org, the website, forestethics.org. And Zipporah, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Tell us about the relationship between the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Caribou.
You know, what a lot of people don't realize is that North America has some of the largest forests that are left on the earth, the Great Northern Boreal Forest that spreads across Canada. And this forest is being logged at about 5 acres a minute, primarily for U.S. consumption. So about 40% of all the newspapers in the United States and the majority of the catalogs in the United States are made from boreal forests, most of it old-growth forests. So there's a direct connection between some of the last wild places on Earth and the newspapers and catalogs that we read in the United States.
What's being done about this?
Well, Forest Ethics has a really unique approach to these issues. We have been approaching corporations and, in many cases, campaigning against corporations to ensure that they use their power and their influence to affect forest protection and forest changes. Mm-hmm. So we have ran campaigns against Staples and Office Depot and are now working with those companies to help use their influence. They've dramatically increased the amount of recycled paper that they use. In fact, an industry report recently said that there is more recycled paper being used today as a result of the demand, the direct demand in the last couple of years by Staples and Office Depot, and that translates to forests protected on the ground. We've actually protected about 7 million acres of forest across Canada and in Chile by harnessing the power of corporations to protect forests.
That's marvelous. I understand that trees are not the most efficient converter of sunlight, water, and air into cellulose, that actually hemp is one of the most efficient, and that there are other plants that are also more efficient than trees. Are there organizations out there getting into promoting alternatives to cutting forests?
Absolutely. You know, if for the catalog industry in the United States, if catalogs just increased the amount of recycled paper it was using to 10% post-consumer recycled content, mm-hmm. That would be enough wood to build a 6-foot fence stretching 7 times across the United States. It would be the equivalent of taking 91,000 cars off the road for a year, because some of these last big areas of wild forest, like the Northern Boreal, are the planet's greatest carbon storehouses, greatest right. terrestrial carbon storehouses.
Albeit short term, but nonetheless, yes. And so, if wow, that's an amazing statistic about the catalogs. And it seems that, you know, maybe it's just because I move so often, but it seems like catalogs are nothing now compared to what's going on the internet. Is the web going to save us?
There's no question that there's an increase in web use, and that's part of what we're advocating when we work with companies and campaign against companies like Victoria's Secret. Our biggest campaign right now is against Victoria's Secret. They're producing 1 million catalogs a day, and most of those are printed on Canadian old-growth forests.
Wait a minute, 365 million catalogs a year?
That's right, 1 million catalogs a day. And actually, next Tuesday, we're calling for a day of action against Victoria's Secret, and there will be hundreds of protests at Victoria's Secret's stores across the country. So there's a direct connection to lingerie and forests. I bet you didn't realize that before.
Another one, yeah. And why, I mean, you know, I suppose it's self-evident, but perhaps not. Perhaps you've drilled down to something that's not self-evident. Why should we be concerned about protecting the forests of northern Canada?
Because globally, 80% of our intact or original forests are already gone. Satellite mapping is showing us that we have about 25% left. a little between 20 and 25%. And in the U.S., 95% of the old-growth forest in the United States is gone. So Canada has about a quarter of what's left on the planet of intact wild forests. And, you know, our borders, to a certain extent, are arbitrary. You know, they're political borders, not ecological borders. So the majority of the birds that you see in the United States are going to be breeding in the northern boreal forests. So it's not only, you know, an incredible place and habitat for numbers of species, for caribou that are declining rapidly, for the last, some of the last large habitat for grizzly bears, but also for birds and, as I mentioned before, an enormous storehouse for carbon, which is an incredible barrier to climate change. So it's important for everyone around the world to be trying to protect some of the last wild places. And it's incredibly important for people in the U.S. to take action now, because the U.S. is the largest consumer of paper and wood from around the world, and specifically from Canada.
Yeah.
You know, we live in a time when what we're seeing is deaf ears on Capitol Hill, when the government is openly unresponsive to environmental issues and, you know, definitely not taking leadership on these issues. But what we are seeing is that in a post-Enron world, corporations are increasingly vulnerable and responsive. And, you know, Americans can vote at the checkout line. You know, we can have a power, we have the power and to change some of these large corporations and therefore to change some of the practices in some of these really important wild places like the northern boreal.
Is forestethics.org, though, the website we're talking with, Sabora Berman, the program director for Forest Ethics. Is Forest Ethics launching or running this campaign essentially alone, or are you part of a coalition of other organizations that are doing it?
We work with a number of organizations from Canada as well as from the United States. The Victoria's Secret campaign is ours, but there's organizations across the United States who have joined our campaign who will be a part of the day of action. And in Canada, we're working on the ground with the local organizations and with First Nations to help find a solution to some of these issues.
And the day of action, again, is going to be when, where, how?
It's going to be next Tuesday. People can find information on our website, forestethics.org, or victoriasdirtysecret.net. And it's next Tuesday, and there'll be protests in cities across the United States.
Hmm, that's great. Thank you very much for being with us. Zipporah Berman, the Program Director for Forest Ethics, forestethics.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
And for the great work you're doing. It's absolutely marvelous.
Thanks.
It's remarkable. Now, moving along, Iran defenses can withstand any invasion. This just out, the Associated Press reports, Iran, over the weekend, Iran tested one new missile system, which has a 1,200-mile range and can operate, they say, beyond the ability of radar to stop. And now this is a second one. This is a surface-to-sea missile, whereas the one that they tested over the weekend was sea-to-surface. A top Iranian military official said Tuesday the country can now defend itself against any invasion originating from outside the region, a clear reference to the United States, as it tested a second new radar-avoiding missile. The new surface-to-sea missile is equipped with remote control and searching systems. State-run television said it said the new missile, called Kausar, after the name of a river in Paradise, was a medium-range weapon that Iran had the capability to mass-produce. It also said their guidance system could not be scrambled, and it was designed specifically to sink ships. So this Iran, I mean, the George W. Bush and all his saber rattling. I mean, you think back to the Cold War, to when Jack Kennedy stared down the Russians during the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example. You think back to the Cold War, and you think back to Dwight Eisenhower talking about, as we heard earlier in the clip that we played earlier in the program, you know, every warship literally represents the theft of food from the mouth of a hungry child. You think of the presidents, even Richard Nixon. Oddly enough, I mean, none of these presidents would have sought a direct confrontation with the Soviet Union. And it's un-American to say that what we are about is about aggression. It is, particularly for political purposes, particularly to win an election, to get political capital. Iran said today, Iran wants durable peace in the Persian Gulf, and it can't be achieved without foreign forces and those which invaded Iraq leaving the region. So, you know, they're getting very specific. Of course, on the other hand, you have over 80% of Iraqis in the latest survey done, done in Iraq, saying that they want the United States to leave. So this is a tough one. By the way, I received a note here from David in Clinton, Washington. He says, about the Supreme Court. He says, Bush wasn't trying to avoid the Supreme Court. He was trying to avoid the court now. He needs to seat one more justice. Then you bet your sweet Bippy he'll aggressively put such a case before them to get all the power he wants. Absolutely. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. The place where being progressive never felt so good. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. You don't know what's going on. No, you're figuring out what's going on really fast. Speaking of Iran and missiles, keeping in mind, you know, the what seemed like a mad policy, mutual assured destruction, the policy that the Soviet Union and the United States maintained really up until the Reagan years. Reagan then started, tried to take it apart with his so-called Star Wars program. The Soviets never took it seriously. They protested it loudly, but they never took it seriously because they knew that it just, you know, it's not viable. It was just an opportunity. It was an attempt on Reagan's part. I mean, part of it was that he was delusional. You know, the guy had Alzheimer's. And part of it was an attempt on his part to transfer $1 trillion from the taxpayers' purse to his friends in a half a dozen large defense companies. Now, pretty simple, you know, companies that were being lobbied for by registered lobbyists and folks like Don Rumsfeld and Caspar Weinberger and so forth. But what it taught us is that, at least so far, you know, thank God, at least so far, countries that have nuclear weapons tend not to get attacked and tend not to attack. In other words, you know, we didn't have a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. India and Pakistan both have nuclear weapons. They haven't attacked each other. And so, you know, there's all this talk now about Iran having the potential to build nuclear weapons. They now have the missiles. But what if they already have the nuclear warheads? This from the Russian News and Information Agency, Novosti. This story out just a few minutes ago. And thanks to Freddie in our chat room, by the way, for giving me a heads up on this thing. You can get to our chat room if you want. Go to tomhartman.com, just click live chat. This story, Dateline Moscow, April 3rd, RIA Novosti. The chief of Russia's general staff said he could neither confirm nor deny reports that Ukraine has sold 250 nuclear warheads to Iran. General Yuri Valievsky, also the deputy defense minister, said in response to an article in the Novaya Gazeta newspaper Monday, Russia's general staff has no information on whether Ukraine has given 250 nuclear warheads to Iran or not. I do not comment on unsubstantiated reports. The newspaper said that Ukraine had failed to return 250 warheads to Russia in the 1990s when the former Soviet Republic declared itself a nuclear-free zone. The paper suggested the warheads could have been sold to a third country, including Iran. So now, you know, the chess game continues. Is this story a plant by friends of Bush to justify cranking up the rhetoric about Iran, to justify a preemptive airstrike that would take out Iran's nuclear facilities and thus cause Iran to retaliate against the United States by whatever means, most likely it wouldn't, you know, Iran wouldn't even need to orchestrate anything. Shia Muslims are, I mean, we've already got the Sunnis upset with us. The Shia Muslims all over the world would become furious with us, and we would see perhaps terrorist attacks against the United States. And that, of course, would cause the Republicans to say, ah, we're the safety and security guys. We're going to keep you safe. Vote for us. And could that be, I mean, you know, this is the Republican election strategy ever since 2000 has been be afraid, be very afraid. Right? I mean, it's just that they're right up front about it. I mean, George W. Bush's speech before the Republican National Convention in 2004.
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists, danger, doomed killers. Be afraid. The world will drift toward tragedy. May God bless you. Evil God, Iraq, darkness. The continuing danger of terrorism. Be afraid. We have fought the terrorists.
And, you know, and it just goes on and on and on. So is this a story that was planted by the Bushies? Or is this Putin saying to the Bushies, be careful, I warned you about Iraq, and now you're going to make the same mistake, but this time, this time you're stepping on a scorpion that has not been defanged.
Pakistan terrorists, Saudi Arabia, Libya, weapons programs, Saddam Hussein terror, weapons of mass destruction, the almighty God, the dictator.
I mean, these are just excerpts from Bush's RNC speech. This is just when he's talking friendly to his friends.
We are defeating the terrorists doing battle in Afghanistan and Iraq. The resurrection, Saddam Hussein's secret police, sadistic punishment, mass graves, radical ideology of hate, kill the innocent, tyranny and terror.
And, you know, compare that to Franklin Roosevelt saying, you know, I see a nation, you know, ill-housed, ill-fed, you know, the Four Freedoms speech. Dwight Eisenhower talking about, you know, a world at war is not just spending its wealth, it's spending the lives of its youth. I mean, oh my. So is this something that's going to restrain the Bush administration, or is this something that's going to further inflame them? This report. And is it going to make it into the American media? We'll see. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been waiting for something to happen. For a week or a month or a year, with the blood and the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before. Where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run.
And welcome back. 26 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you at Jackson Browne. JacksonBrowne.com. You'll find just an absolutely amazing video. I have a link to it off the top of TomHartman.com that was put together to a live performance of Jackson Browne singing that song, and just an extraordinary video montage about war and peace in the United States. Really remarkable. Bill Maher had Dana Rohrabacher on his program recently, the Bill Maher Show. Dana Rohrabacher, of course, the quite toxic Republican, right-wing extremist, I think you could safely characterize. In fact, he would probably characterize himself that way. And so we added a little music to it, and here it is.
Silence is golden, but my eyes still see.
Oh, stop it.
Oh, come on.
You're telling me...
You're never going to command of anything, Bill. Come on.
But if I was, I wouldn't sit there like Forrest Gump.
Sure you wouldn't. Sure you would.
Wait a second. You're telling me...
Now, what this is about, let me just interrupt this, what this is about is... George W. Bush being told that the nation was under attack and sitting there like Forrest Gump for 7 minutes in that classroom on November 11th, 9/11/2001.
I was going to listen. Sometimes under pressure.
Come on, Dana. I know you're too long. You're telling me if Bill Clinton was president and he sat there for 7 minutes after being told America's under attack, you'd defend him?
Duh. Dana Rohrabacher, speechless. Absolutely speechless. It's just incredible when you just kind of flip things around and say, you know, can you imagine if Al Gore had been president of a company that got billions and billions of dollars in contracts for a war that didn't need to be and still owned stock and was profiting on the thing and was still being paid over a salary every month larger than what he got as vice president of the United States, and that company was then accused of mishandling, misappropriating, misusing, wasting, stealing hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of U.S. dollars. Can you imagine if that had happened during the Clinton administration? Sheila in Las Vegas on the line. Hey, Sheila, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about our nuclear test. Well, they're saying it's not a nuclear test, but in effect, this is a tactical nuke. I've called the Environmental Agency, the Defense Department, the mayor, the governor. The only ones who really care are Shelley Berkeley and Harry Reid. But what really got me yesterday, the Las Vegas Sun did a story on this, and they're telling us that we're fraidy cats and that we should just drink our atomic cocktail and shut up.
Now, just for the rest of the nation who may not be familiar with this story, that's very real and in your face for you there in Las Vegas.
Yes. 700... I'm sorry, you say it.
Yeah, well, the Bush administration is planning on testing bunker-busting bombs in the nuclear test range just upwind from Las Vegas, and they said the citizens of Las Vegas will probably feel the earthquake and see the mushroom cloud.
Yes, and it's ammonium nitrate and fuel, which I'm finding out is very dangerous. It's a dangerous chemical when heated up with this other fuel, and
it's what Tim McVeigh used to take down the federal building.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
Plus, it's so big, the thing wouldn't even get into a plane. So I talked to the man at the Environmental Protection, or I guess it was the Energy Department this morning, and he said to me, I said, if you couldn't get it in a plane, what are you going to do with it? Stand a truck in front of a bunker to let it go off? He said, we're piping it in. Well, I said, you're not piping it in on enemy territory. What is this all for except to make Bush look macho by looking at a big mushroom cloud and showing our power?
Yeah, yeah. I agree with you, Sheila. I think that this is the Bush administration, not just for domestic consumption, but also to say to Iran, you know, that we have this weapon. We can get you no matter how deeply buried your nuclear systems are and all that sort of thing.
Well, what gets me is that I said to him, shouldn't you notify the citizens of Las Vegas? You've already notified Russia that this is going on. He said it's not necessary.
Well, the Bush administration has already written off Las Vegas. I mean, and Nevada, for that matter. I mean, they're going ahead with their nuclear waste siting there after Bush promised he wouldn't in the 2000 election.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, they've already written it off. Sheila, thanks for the call. It's a good point, and it's just, what can you say? Ron in Renton, Washington. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
Well, remember right back before they were trying to pass the energy bill, I believe, the first time they had that power shortage in New York, New Jersey, I believe Ohio, Wisconsin, whatever.
Right.
I think
it was all the states except Vermont, because I was living in Vermont at the time, and you know we had our own power grid there. So.
Right. I think that might have been orchestrated because they were trying to pass that energy bill at the time, and you were talking about that article about them shutting down power in just about any country they wanted to. I think that could have been orchestrated way back then.
That's interesting. Interesting idea. Yeah, I just don't know, Ron, but you raise an interesting point. By the way, Benedict in the chat room suggested that maybe this story that I shared with you from the Russian press was actually planted by Iran by way of saying to George W. Bush, You try this, this is what you'll have coming back at you. Interesting, because Bush doesn't attack countries that he knows can fight back. That's why we haven't gone after North Korea. Even though if you want to liberate people from a horrible dictatorship, there's the country to start. Jeff in South Hero, Vermont. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Okay, thanks for taking my call. Listen, in all due respect, I love what you're saying out here, but the last 10 days, I had some problems about, the anti-immigration stuff.
I'm not opposed to immigration. I'm opposed to illegal immigration.
Okay. No.
In fact, I've come out and said I think that our refugee immigration quotas should be dramatically lifted.
Sure, but I think there's been a lot of rhetoric while you're doing this out here that I've heard, from callers. And A, I want to say this, that, you know, I think this, comes straight from the Republican Party for the next election. Immigration right now is what gay issues were 2 years ago. That they're just beating up on things. And I'm kind of surprised that, we're talking about this a lot.
I agree with you that it's a hot issue, Jeff.
Yeah.
I agree with you. And the Republican Party is split on this. So you've got the corporatists on one hand.
Well, I'm split on it, too. I don't know quite what to do, but as a liberal, and I'm a union guy too, okay? I work for the post office.
Mm-hmm.
I got my own opinions on it, but I personally don't think that the problems in this country economically or job-wise have anything to do with immigrants. I think they have to do with, corporatist, anti-democratic people in our government.
Who are making policies that are causing our manufacturing jobs to go overseas,
right?
Because things can be manufactured overseas,
right?
And that are causing
that.
The jobs that don't involve manufacturing that have to be done domestically, things like
right.
house building and working in restaurants and things like that. They're importing cheap labor for this. You can boil the entire conservative agenda down to two words: cheap labor. Whether it's outsourcing our jobs to other nations by moving our manufacturing offshore, or whether it's by bringing cheap labor into this country. And I think it's important for liberals, progressives, Democrats to stand up and speak out on this.
Well, I think it is too, but I think this is a real non-issue that's going on, to cloud things politically. And, I don't mean to disagree with you.
You're welcome to disagree with me. To at a certain level, I would agree,
in
as much
for,
as I would say it's a symptom of a deeper problem.
But I
but
think it's
a symptom
up for
that is,
a reason right now.
Say that again?
I think that's coming up for a reason right now.
Oh, sure.
To cloud a lot of stuff. And I honestly think, the immigration problem in this country, even labor-wise, I think is such a small tip of what's really going on. I mean, we're talking about 3, 4, 5% of the people, working jobs that other people could do. I think there's far bigger issues we should be discussing.
Well, Jeff, you've got 3, 4, 5% of the people who are unemployed too and desperately want jobs. I mean, 5% of the American workforce is not a small number of people.
Well, no, I agree with that, but I just think you were talking the other day about labor cost. Labor cost, right?
Right.
Not having much to do with what the actual cost of the product is.
Well, it has some effect on it.
But it's a small part.
Right.
And I just think that this is one of those mood issues of like I say about a couple of years ago, bring up the gay issue and throwing things around.
But the gay issue is just pure and simple bigotry.
I kind of think this immigration thing is too, to be honest.
It is for the bigots. I agree with you. That's the piece that I wrote for Common Dreams. I recommend you check that out.
I'll go look at it.
Yeah, in fact, it might have scrolled off the page by now, in which case you go to tomhartman.com and just click Articles on Democracy. And the title of it is Corporatists versus Racists and Labor is Left Behind. You've got the racists out there on one side, they want to build a fence. You got the corporatists on the other side, they want an amnesty or guest worker program or braceros, and nobody's talking about the real issue, which
is a tough issue.
Yeah, it really is, and there aren't simple answers.
All right.
Jeff, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Many's the hour I've lain by my window, and thought of the people who carry the burden, who marched into strange fields in search of an answer, and ended their journeys an unwilling hero.
And welcome back, my friends.
Oh, here's a song to those who are gone with never a reason why, and a toast of the wine at the end of the line, and a toll of the bell for the next one to die.
9 minutes before the hour. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Ed in Arlington, Washington on the line. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Great show.
Thank you.
I had an answer to your last caller and others who call and think it's a fine idea for foreign nationals of any country to just come and settle and get all the benefits. And I would like to present a scenario. The guy sounded like he was a good, hard-working, middle-class kind of guy. And let's assume that a busload of international undocumented people show up in his neighborhood. And they decide, well, let's go in through this guy's back door or crawl through the window. And then when we get there, we'll just eat his food and we'll put ourselves on his insurance agent, you know, on his insurance bill. We'll take care of his lawn, maybe. We might even, go ahead and date his dog.
Ed, I don't think it's that insidious. I mean, I get your metaphor, but it's really not that insidious. The reason why nations have national boundaries is the same reason why we have families. It's the same reason why there are clans. It's the same reason why there are tribes. It's the same reason why we form cities and states. And that is to have a shared common interest and a consensus among us about the standards by which we want to live. And one of the things, probably the most important of the standards that we define about how we want to live is the economic standard. What is our standard of living going to be like? And the economic standard of living is a function of wages. And wages, as David Ricardo wrote back in 1814, wages are a function of the relationship in the marketplace between the available pool of labor and the demand for that labor. And to the extent that the pool of labor can be increased so that the demand is decreased, then the price will drop with the demand. It's just that simple. And so that's one of the reasons why nations, you know, we in the United States, we've decided, hey, we want to have a democratic republic, constitutionally limited democratic republic. In Mexico, they've decided it's fine for them to have an oligarchy. There are different forms of government. They, you know, there are some surface appearance similar, but they're different. And that's why you say, okay, this is our boundary and this is our country. I mean, if I went over to Norway and said, hi, I'm here, I want a job, they'd laugh at me. They'd throw me out. I've actually considered it. My grandfather came here from Norway in 1917. That doesn't cut me any slack.
Right.
You know, I'm the grandson of an immigrant, and I can't, you know, every other nation in the world protects their borders and enforces them, and this is not a matter of racism or paranoia. It's a matter of, frankly and fundamentally, it's a matter of economics.
It boils down to protecting our home.
Yeah, it boils
That's
down
great.
To protecting your way of life. And again, that is a line that can be used jingoistically by the racists, particularly on the right, and is, but I don't mean it in that way. I mean it as I said, this is about economics. You can boil the entire conservative agenda down to two words, cheap labor, and that's what this is all about. Ed, I gotta move along. I appreciate the call. It's good to hear from you. John in, Joe in Sacramento, California. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, what's happening, Tom? Glad to get on the radio. Little nervous. I've been waiting to get on here for 10 days, and hopefully this is good. I want to reiterate what the last caller, not the last caller, but a couple before, that said he was surprised to hear the comments coming from our side towards illegal immigration. I definitely agree with you. I think it's a problem that we need to handle. We need to get take care of. We need to protect Americans' wages. But by putting the burden on the immigrants and making that a felony here, I think the reason why we saw so many demonstrations, now me being a Mexican-American, this is a hard issue that is really at heart, I think is because now if you turn them into felonies, now what you're saying is now you're looking at brown people in the United States. There are 40 million legal Latinos living in the United States. That's one in every seven Americans. Now if you make being a immigrant illegal and they're basically brown, then you're turning the whole
now you got a racial profiling nightmare.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Not that we don't already. I would suggest to you, Joe, that we do already do, but I agree with you. I think that the whole Sensenbrenner approach, the Republican approach of let's criminalize the aliens and let's criminalize the people who are helping them is adding insult to injury. It's the effectively, you know, it's like. It's blame the victim is what it is.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
And if we're going to get a handle on this, it's just like, you know, I've said this before, we wouldn't have a drug problem. We wouldn't have to worry about other countries growing cocaine or opium if we didn't buy it. It's there's demand here in the United States, and therefore people are bringing things in. And there's demand for illegal cheap labor, and therefore people will fill that demand. When the demand goes away, the people will say, hey, you know, there's no job here. I'm going to go back home and make my country a better place.
Exactly. And, Tom, thank you for bringing these issues to the forefront. Having a forum to be able to even speak like this is excellent. But I just want to remind everybody listening on the air that there are 40 million legal Latinos living in the United States right now.
And
my family's gone back centuries. And then just to hear this kind of stuff that's happening, it's crazy. I work on a landscaping site. And to hear that all landscapers are illegals, it's just something that's, you know, just touching a nerve a little bit.
Oh, it's got to make you crazy, Joe. And the Latino culture, by the way, in the United States, is by and large a conservative, law-abiding culture. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, crazed criminals here or anything like that.
Definitely.
We're talking about
good
people. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. And we'll, to the other folks on hold here, we'll get to you tomorrow. In fact, coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, I'll be debating conservative Michael LeGault about the five greatest media myths. Jeffrey Feldman will be here about the new Democratic frame. Larry Scott from VAWatchdog.org about the Army banning the use of privately bought armor. That and more in your calls here on the Tom Hartman program, the Radio Free Speech Zone. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you as well. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
I'm here with Bill, who is a GSK scientist.